So, okay. So, as you know, tonight it's More Ways to Fix the World, Part 3. Just to remind everyone, I decided off the top of my head to do 10 Ways to Fix the World because I thought it would be easy, and rapidly discovered that, of course, it was impossible, at least in one talk, so I had to break it into three talks. So far, I've covered 7 topics, starting with 1, don't do stupid stuff, which, you know, would obviously include wars and various obviously stupid things. Look after the environment, organise food and water, make energy sustainable, improve health by not making everyone ill, improve science by not chasing profits, and reorganise production and distribution in line with a slower is better principle. So that's 7. So I've got 3 left, which are going to be democracy, education, and housing. I could have picked other subjects. I mean, you know, the sky's the limit with this sort of thing, but I thought I'd stick to 10. Of course, I'm going to be talking about what these things might look like, but also what it is about them which could help fix the planet. So trying to stay on message with that. I should also acknowledge that in places I will be pinching ideas off other members involved in the collective rewrite project of the Socialism as a Practical Alternative pamphlet. We quite enjoy having these meetings. It's a sort of opportunity for a bit of blue sky socialist thinking that we don't often get a chance to do in the party. Okay, so I suppose this talk is another example of that. So I'm going to start with democracy, and I'm not going to dwell too much on how a better democracy can fix the world, because it's kind of self-evident. If humans had a collective say in planetary management, we wouldn't be choosing to drive climate change and species extinction. Today's billionaires are doing that. They're like reckless children shitting where we all sleep. And only a democratic revolution can really stop them and hand the planet back to the adults. But what does this democracy mean? What will it look like? We often say that socialism will be a fully democratic system without interrogating what that concept actually means. I remember some years ago, Bill Martin gave a really good talk, I think at head office, where he went through all the various voting systems that you could conceivably have, and he sort of proved, to my satisfaction anyway, that no system is fully democratic, because with any voting system, there are potential circumstances where the majority don't get their first choice, or even sometimes their second choice. So all systems are going to be a bit of a compromise at some level. Now, by analogy, in cryptographic circles, the nostrum is that no code is unbreakable forever. But for most general purposes, a thing called PGP encryption is acceptable. Now, this PGP isn't some obscure bit of techno jargon. It just stands for pretty good privacy. And in a similar way, I think we can say that no decision-making system is perfect, but we can aim for PGD, which I'm sure you can guess means pretty good democracy. Now, as I see it, there are 2 basic approaches to this. There's the legacy or standard model that is practiced in some form pretty much around the world today. It's legacy because it's geography based, so you get included in or excluded out of votes based on where you live. This is an obvious convenience in pre-internet days when you literally couldn't pack thousands of people into a hall, and direct democracy just wasn't possible. Its main virtue for socialists is that people at least understand it. And a strong guiding principle of the early days of socialism, which I've been reminded of recently is that we should start from where we are. So initially, representative forms of democracy, councils, regional assemblies, global administration, that kind of thing, that might well be the norm. That might be where we start. The main downside is the bureaucracy of it all, and the fear that people will spend all day in meetings instead of actually doing anything. This is something that I think probably a lot of us have had thrown at us about socialism. But also the parallel fear that people will ignore the democracy and just vote with their feet, which would lead to opaque and undemocratic decision making. And also, in this day and age, the sheer geographical arbitrariness of giving some people a vote who couldn't care less, and know even less than that, while depriving others of a vote who are strongly motivated and well-informed. This model really depends on everyone participating properly. If people aren't voting, that's a sign that the system is working badly. Now, as I say, given modern communications, there is a strong argument for doing away with this indirect representative model. I'm not going to, sort of re-emphasise what kind of representative democracy the party normally talks about, that it's mandatory, not all that sort of thing. You all know that. But it is still a representative model. Now, in a direct democracy, decisions are made by the sum total of votes, pro and con, and not mediated through representative committees. But since everyone voting on everything would be chaos, the question arises, what are the voting criteria? Now, I did talk about this at a summer school in 2021, in a talk called Democracy and the Rule of Three, which is actually on the website under Resources, Audio Index, Summer Schools. But I'll just briefly recap it here for anyone who hasn't heard that, just so that you know what I'm talking about. So, in this model has been called organic democracy, in that it sort of grows out from the individual rather than sort of affects the individual from outside, from external structures. Organic democracy does not presuppose any a priori democratic architecture. So things like regular conferences, your big meeting halls, committee schedules, all the sort of, you know, paraphernalia of you know, existing democratic structures. Instead, what you get in a sort of organic way is self-organizing activity around a perceived problem, analogous to antibodies forming around an infection. And once the problem has been solved, the self-organizing activity group dissipates. That's not to say there would be no permanent structures. Plainly, some problems are ongoing, like, you know, health, resource planning, transport planning, lots and lots of things. There will probably be ongoing things, and there will therefore be ongoing structures. The organic approach means that structures form to deal with problems, not that structures exist, whether there's a need for them or not. To give an example closer to home, we recently got rid of ADM because it seemed redundant, although I have to admit I'm starting to wonder if we made a bit of a mistake there. But even so, we as a party are a very classically arranged party. I think someone once said we were based on a union model, 19th century union model. In any case, we're not what you would call organic. We still have an annual conference agenda, which, you know, some of the time, or maybe a lot of the time, seems to consist of filler material that we put in there just because we have an annual conference and we have to put something. And we sometimes have committees with nobody on them. When your democratic architecture becomes rather ritualistic in this way, you're really serving it. It's not serving you. If we were more organic, we would hold conferences and form committees only when and if we deemed them necessary, not as a standard rule. Now, a a really key difference in this organic model is that nobody elects anyone. Nobody is elected to anything. You opt into these groups and vote according to personal choice based on the principle of from each according to ability to each according to need, which could be summed up by some version of three self-test criteria, which is what I called the rule of three. So they are, do you know about it? Does it affect you? Do you care? Now, as a free agent in socialism, you're also assumed to be a responsible person and to opt in or out in a responsible manner. You don't meddle in things you don't understand or care about. If you do care about something, you're expected to take the trouble to inform yourself properly. So it's a trust model. Not possible under capitalism, where most people, most of the time, are happy to leave matters to those who know and care about what they're doing. It depends on simplicity, on transparency, on people not participating when they don't meet these criteria. It depends on taking the noise out of the decision-making. To the extent that people aren't voting in this system, that's a sign that it is working well. In capitalism, as we know, we are disempowered. We have no say in anything much at all. One effect is that people are alienated from democratic participation because they see it as essentially meaningless. That's why council elections typically only inspire a 30% or so turnout. General elections do better, maybe 60%, sometimes 70 tops, but you're still talking about 30% of people who just don't bother. So it's hard to say how people will be in socialism. If everyone is super engaged in everything, well, perhaps the indirect representational model will work. If, on the whole, conversely, people aren't too bothered as long as things seem to be working okay, which is actually what I would expect, then I think the organic model could be the way to go. What I do think is unreasonable is the idea that people wouldn't want to vote at all and instead leave all the decision making to machines. This was at the core of the Zeitgeist concept of a technology-led world run by AI systems. Now, of course, AI can be incredibly useful in finding a lot of patterns in complex global data sets so that human decision-making is based on the best possible information. But AI can only ever be a set of tools. The great drawback of AI is that it lacks intentionality. It doesn't know what we want. It doesn't want anything for itself. Only we know what we want. Only we have agency. And agency is the key thing. We must have agency to be properly functioning, free and responsible human beings. That agency is what capitalism takes away from us. And that's what we urgently need to take back. The idea of voluntarily handing that agency over to some automated system, I think, is downright perverse. I think it's the product of an infantilized capitalist mindset, which sees us all as being and wishing to remain feckless children who don't want to bother our heads with grown-up matters. Which leads me conveniently to the second topic tonight, which is education. Now, in the same way as democracy, education can help fix the world simply by not being capitalist brainwashing aimed at churning out obedient zombies, and instead reorienting itself towards practical knowledge and skills, and what are called soft skills, social and environmental awareness, cooperation and sharing, empathy, personal responsibility, initiative, and self-reliance. And I thought I'd start this section by considering what we mean by the words child and childhood, because those concepts have changed through the ages. I don't think it's controversial to say that today's concept of the child is a rather artificial construct built around progressive capitalist reforms, initially aimed simply at keeping children out of the workforce. So I think children are hypocritically fictionalised as paragons of innocence, while at the same time society imposes rigid economic and patriarchal structures which result in an epidemic of child abuse. They are the most disempowered of any section of society, the most punished, and in some ways the most misunderstood. When I was doing teacher training many years ago, I read all the works of A.S. Neal, Ivan Illich, and John Holt. I had to get the books out of the town library because they weren't in teaching college library. And I duly wrote enthusiastic and feverish essays about free schooling approaches, leaning heavily on the argument that the word educate comes from the Latin educare, meaning to lead out, i.e. to stimulate and encourage and develop the latent interests and aptitudes of the individual, rather than treating the child in the Victorian model as a blank slate to be written on, or empty vessel to be filled, or in today's terminology, a clean computer to be programmed. Now, not surprisingly, these essays earned D's and E's from my tutors. Capitalist schools are not free in any sense, and no teaching college today has any use for such libertarian notions. In the book How Children Fail, John Holt, who was a former maths teacher, shocked by the perceived irrelevance of his own subject among his pupils, wrote that you could safely throw out 90% of the school curriculum because children throw it out anyway. In his books on Summerhill, A.S. Neal described what a child-centred school looked like, where children voted on how the school was run, opted for which lessons to go to, if any, and were free to go to do whatever they liked as long as they did no harm to other people. Neal's motto was freedom, not license. And incidentally, according to Wikipedia's page on Summerhill, one of the founder teachers was the daughter of an SPGB founder member. It's an interesting entry, actually, because there's a whole bit about the outrageous efforts of the government and Ofsted in 2000 to close the school down on the basis that it was failing. In fact, it wasn't, and they were being dishonest, and the effort to shut it down was successfully defeated in court. But anyway, most children today don't have access to these so-called free schools like Summerhill or another one called Sands in Devon, which is an offspring of Dartington Hall. They don't have access because these so-called free schools have, I'm told, higher fees than Eton. So they've got no option but to go to state schools, and of course these are not designed for the benefit of children. I heard a joke when I was doing teacher training. There's a joke that went, "Mummy, mummy, I don't want to go to school anymore. It's horrible. The teachers are mean, everyone bullies me, and the work is boring and pointless." To which mummy replies, "Darling, you've got to go. You're the headmaster." Now, I will admit to having an almost pathological aversion to schools and schooling, and a distrust of teachers, which has caused certain problems for my children and friction with friends who are teachers. I didn't much like school as a kid, but I really hated it as a teacher. I saw schools as basically capitalist day-release penitentiaries, which allow the parents to provide surplus value to some employer, where the teachers are effectively prison officers, the syllabus are relentless conveyor belts with an excruciating exam-based torture system, and a hidden curriculum of obedience to rules, loyalty to the boss, and love for the nation. My teaching experience was that kids weren't stupid. They instinctively understood all this, and class war existed in every classroom, with me feeling like I was on the wrong side. Anyway, you won't be surprised to learn that I did not pursue a career as a school teacher. This is not to speak ill of teachers, by the way. I have met some supremely gifted teachers, genuinely able to inspire, even given the coercive constraints they operate within. But they are the exceptions, in post because of a true sense of vocation and not just, like most workers, in desperate need of a job to pay the rent and bills. No system that relies on its exceptions can be said to be viable. So I took the Ivan Illich view that in socialism we would de-school society by abolishing and tearing down all school buildings and institutional frameworks. Children, as I saw it, would be better off freely selecting their own educational mentors from among the local community. But I've modified this view. You can learn a lot by doing, but there are practical limits to this. So now I think specialised centres could exist, not to mention universities. Certainly the caretaker function of capitalist schools, you know, as a place just to stick the kids while the parents are busy being wage slaves, that would be obsolete. Even so, there would be some efficiency gain in gathering together multiple experts in one physical location. And I say physical location because recent experiments with online university learning in the USA and also during the pandemic have shown very high dropout rates. People actually do need to meet in person for good learning to take place. And of course the key difference in socialist education would be that it would not be compulsory. It would not have a syllabus imposed from outside by ideological elites and market forces, but instead that syllabus would be decided according to the socialist principle, once again, of to each according to self-defined need. And it wouldn't be a factory-like one-and-done experience for the youth. It would be understood as a lifelong activity, something a lot of teachers talk about even today, lifelong learning, but states don't have the money or won't find the money to pay for. So adult education has been destroyed in this country. But in socialism, it would be a lifelong activity, something everyone does and enjoys doing at any age, and always pursued according to personal interest and aptitude. And the other side of learning, of course, is teaching. Just as everyone is a learner, they're also a teacher. The two are part of the same process. If you learn anything interesting from this talk, then I suppose it can be said to be fulfilling this function. As part of my own lifelong learning, I'm just now reading a new book called Good Nature by Professor Kathy Willis, which I went and bought in the hardback form after listening to her being interviewed by The Economist. Anyway, it's all about new research into how natural environments benefit our physical and mental health. Yes, you'd think, all right, that's intuitively obvious, but I was surprised at how much actual research has been into this that confirms it. She cites multiple comparative studies showing that where school classrooms have open views of fields, grass and trees, the kids do much better at memory tests than in rooms with views of houses or brick walls or no windows at all. And the same is true in hospitals. Health outcomes are consistently better in hospital wards with green or leafy views than ones where there's no view. The obvious conclusion I leapt to was that, oh, that's because they're posher hospitals for richer people and posher schools for rich people. But apparently they thought of that and they designed the test to control for that. So that's apparently not the case. Be that as it may, in socialism, whether we're learning or teaching, or we're working or recuperating, we have to be in some building somewhere. But socialist theory, to my recollection, has expended relatively little effort in considering what our physical built environment might be like. And that's why, for the final entry in my 10 Ways to Fix the World, I want to do something that I think is quite interesting and look at the thing that we all spend most of our lives in, which is the house itself. Now, before I start waxing lyrical about architecture and lifestyle and all that sort of thing, I have to remind myself that socialism has got to start from where we are. And, of course, where we are now includes the pressing matter of homeless people living on the streets. This is actually a non-problem, which was solved overnight in the pandemic and will be solved overnight in socialism. As things are, there are plenty of empty houses available for homeless people. I took 5 minutes to look this up, and it turns out that for every person in America without a roof, there are on average 28 vacant homes. In the UK, for every person without a roof, there are on average 75 vacant homes. And that's not even the whole story. The UK has around 270,000 homeless, of which around 2,700 are sleeping on the streets. But it also has 200,000 empty homes and 1.5 million derelict homes that just need doing up. The World Economic Forum estimated that at least 150 million people are homeless around the world, or there were in 2021. Meanwhile, the OECD estimates that there are 42 million empty homes in the world. These are approximations, so there could be many more. So, of course, the homeless people and the homes might not be in the same places. But even so, with a bit of juggling and house sharing globally, it's easy to see that everyone could have somewhere to live if not overnight, but in a couple of days or a week. So, non-problem. So, that would be the first thing to deal with. But the next question would be, well, okay, how do people want to live in socialism? In what way can we make accommodation more environmentally sustainable? A lot of architects are asking this question now. In many countries today, people live in apartments anyway, not houses. Apartments are intrinsically more communal than houses, and they're also more eco-friendly. But they don't have the individual green outdoor spaces, which would upset devotees of Kathy Willis, the good nature professor. Initially, we'd have to find ways to allocate existing housing stock. I'm not sure how we would do this, but people at the time will decide. But presumably, according to criteria like availability, condition, size of family, access to infrastructure, transport, transients, and so forth. I put in transients. I mentioned transients because of a parallel factor, which is that we don't know to what extent populations would choose to be static or mobile in socialism, given free choice and a decent public transport network. My supposition has always been that young people will tend to be transients, off to see the world, because why wouldn't they? While older people will be more likely to settle in one place for family and community reasons. I imagine that the transients will do the lion's share of the world's low-skilled work. The statics, if I can call them that, will do the specialised expert work. So, okay, let's say I'm a transient. I fetch up in Barcelona or Manila and I need a bed. I find the nearest accommodation office. I tell them how long I plan to stay and they allocate me a room in one of the existing dormitory complexes or formerly hotels or the spare room network, whatever. Where, as in youth hostels, I don't know if youth hostels still do this, but they certainly did when I used to go youth hosteling. I would do a bit of cleaning or cooking or maintenance of some sort as my voluntary contribution. Transient populations would be pretty easy to deal with. They wouldn't expect much, they wouldn't need much, they wouldn't be staying very long. If there were large transient communities like today's Travellers or Roma, well, they would take their accommodation with them. Permanent static community members will presumably have more sophisticated requirements with a stronger investment in their location. So we would have to think at some point about new builds and future town planning. Now, of course, these things are being thought about today. Right now, the world is urbanising at a rate of knots, 70% by 2050. 70% of the world urbanised by 2050 is the rate. Advanced capitalist countries are orienting towards sustainable cities, 15-minute cities, you know, where everything you need is within a 15-minute walk. Now, 15-minute cities, weirdly, the subject of conspiracy theories, which just shows that people can make a conspiracy out of anything if they're so-minded. Now, the key characteristics of a sustainable city, I know because I stole this off some website, are the implementation of green infrastructure, use of urban farming, efficient public transport, operations on renewable energy sources, waste management, and water conservation. Okay, all right, so I think all this just reflects is that so many of the things that would need to be decided in socialism are already being discussed today and decided today. So, you know, in so many ways, we wouldn't have to reinvent the wheel. Now, historically, this urbanisation was driven, of course, by the need to find employment. And maybe this is why Marx supposed that a post-capitalist society would to some extent reverse this urbanisation process. In fact, I think what he said was that the town would become the country and the country would become the town. I'm not sure that's correct, because if, as many of us suspect, private cars will largely be replaced by public transport, there would be a pressure to concentrate people into urban areas to make the public transport serve the most people, and perhaps into apartment complexes surrounded by green spaces. Now, this would obviously upset devotees of William Morris. But urban centres are more environmentally efficient than scattered rural idylls. The private house, with its own kitchen, bathroom, etc., which is in any case a somewhat UK-centric notion, and was to a large extent invented by the Victorians, the private house could go the same way as the private car. That doesn't necessarily mean everyone would have to live in joyless concrete high-rises in the manner of 1960s brutalism. And this is where architecture comes in. If communal accommodation can be made beautiful, airy, full of light, and exuberant with greenery, that wouldn't be so bad. Perhaps it could be in the form of networked semi-urban farms on the kibbutz model. In any case, I do find it difficult to comprehend why we would globally fight so hard to create a sharing communal world and then demand to live separately at huge expense in space and resources. What would certainly disappear is the fetishized nature of property ownership in capitalism, where wage slaves struggle for decades to protect their sunk costs in the name of security. If you could go anywhere and be confident that you'd find reasonable accommodation, you'd be less likely to fixate on the idea of your home being your personal castle, and instead see it as a communal resource which you are temporarily occupying, and you'd look after it responsibly as such. Just to underline this, other societies, other communities don't look at property in this way at all. Traditional societies like the Inuit have no concept of private ownership or the wage slavery required to achieve it. I looked at a page about Inuit just out of interest, and it turns out the Inuit see Europeans as essentially unstable and perpetually anxious. They have a word for Europeans, which is tukuma, which means people who have too much to do. And as for the native Australian attitude to private property, I've done this before, I'm fond of quoting it. It's a line from Crocodile Dundee where he says that to the Aborigines, fighting over who owns the land is like fleas fighting over who owns the dog. But hold on, let's just slam on the brakes for a minute. Let's not run away with this idea. And suggest that, contrary to my suppositions, people in the socialist society do indeed insist on living in separate homes, perhaps because community is all very well, but we all appreciate a bit of privacy too. So it all comes back to architecture again. Now, here I must admit a certain personal interest. I wouldn't say I'm a kind of architect anorak. Oh, by the way, anorak is a Canadian Inuit word, and parka is an Alaskan Inuit word. You see the things you find out when you Google. But I was quite inspired by a book I read that described architecture as an art gallery that you live in. Architecture, said the book, is about two things: function and statement, what the building is for and what it is trying to say. So let's look at architecture's function. So I looked up, the first thing I looked up is, if people wanted to live in separate houses, they would need to be sustainable housing. So I looked at what an architect said about sustainable housing. The architect said, you need location near infrastructure. Smaller square houses are more efficient than oblong houses or round houses. Heating, ventilation and AC, HVAC, is the biggest expense. You want to orient towards the sun on the south side if you're in the northern hemisphere, and opposite the other way around. You want a lot of glass on that side, triple glazed, small windows on the north side that doesn't get much sun, local and recycled materials, avoid volatile organic compounds in paint, glue, etc., insulation and tight air sealing with mechanical breathing, not through walls, because that creates condensation and damp. LED lighting, water conservation, smart thermostats and split zones, that's where you've got different parts of the house at different temperatures, energy recovery, ventilation, rainwater collection, renewable energy, solar, geothermal, wind, also a vegetable garden growing native species that will grow in your climate. Build it to last and build something you love. Okay, there you go. That's that's, if you were having your own house built today, that would be your wish list. But of course, for almost everyone now, sustainable eco-housing is completely unaffordable. And generally, it can only be for new build, because you just can't retrofit all this into existing housing stock. So in socialism, building would depend on local conditions, the availability of local materials and expertise. Building could be a communal activity. I'm sure it doesn't take a huge amount of skill. If I want to volunteer for a local team, I'm sure I can carry a few bricks around or something. But I come back to a question I've asked a lot before. Would all these houses need separate kitchens? In ancient Rome, people lived in high-rises with no washing or cooking facilities, and they just ate out all the time at street stalls or cafes, and they used bathhouses. Socialist communities could do similar to save energy. Cooking could be another communal activity which would vastly cut down on time and waste. Roman-style baths might even make a comeback for the same reason. So that was architecture as function. Now I want to talk about architecture as statement. I am drawing towards a close, do not worry. Now, as I mentioned, architecture serves an obvious purpose, but it also makes statements. I did have some pictures, but I don't really need to show them to you, of today's what's called hostile architecture. If you've never heard of hostile architecture, it's things like putting bars on park benches so that people can't sleep on them. And there are other things about places where people are likely to sleep overnight in doorways, putting spikes there. This is called hostile architecture, and the statement is very clear: if you're homeless, we don't want you here. Historically, though, architecture has made altogether grander statements. If you look at the neoclassical frontage of the Bank of England or the White House and think about the statement that it's making all about power and prestige, and then look at the revivalist styles of the Victorians, to whom money was no object and the world was their oyster, and you can read it right there, the exultant mindset of that imperial age. And then look at this dull, functionalist, scrimping uniformity of the 20th century, shattered by two world wars that had no desire to look back except in anger, and pinned all its hopes on modernism and the bright gleam of glass and steel. What statements would socialism want to make? This year we had our summer school in Worcester, and afterwards me and Dougie decided to go for a wander round the cathedral, which is a soaring example of medieval religious nutjobbery expressed in the Gothic Perpendicular style. And we happened to run into Kat Rylance, also from summer school, who was also doing the same thing. And it turned out she was thinking the same thing as us. What would socialist architecture look like? Would it be severe, functional, strictly resource conscious, as people had other priorities and interests and didn't much care what their built environment looked like? Or would it be an exuberant renaissance of playful experimentation and perhaps revivalism of everything from Gothic to Gaudi? Resource efficiency be damned, in an effort to showcase the sparkle and spirit of a new beginning where humans were free to enjoy their lives for the first time in recorded history. I think you can guess which option we were hoping for. And that's the end of my 10 ways to fix the world. Thank you for listening.